Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. New York Times columnist Michelle Goldberg joins us now with the South Carolina primary tomorrow and new questions about coronavirus preparedness continuing to arise today. Thanks for joining us, Michelle. It's always great to have you on.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So at the top of your Twitter feed this morning was part of a New York Times article about the new federal government whistleblower on federal workers being sent to meet coronavirus evacuees arriving back in the U.S., without proper training or equipment, and having their own health concerns dismissed as bad for morale, and even had their emotional stability questioned for raising health concerns about this assignment. So you tweeted, huh, wonder where this dysfunctional culture comes from. What can you tell us about that story, and what kind of dysfunctional culture are you pointing at?
Okay, well, you know, with the caveat that I was commenting on this story, I didn't report it, but I think we've already, you know, you've seen occasionally people say, well, Trump hasn't really faced a big crisis yet, and that's not of his own making, and here it is, and he's demonstrating his incompetence. And that's not quite true, because we did see Trump have to face a big crisis not of his own making in Puerto Rico. It just didn't involve people who can vote in American elections, right? And it was a disaster. It's a catastrophe. It's still a catastrophe. And so I think we're seeing the fact that, you know, we actually have a layer of people who are several degrees less qualified than the people who were in government at that time, right? This is really the D-list. He's gutted the civil service, you know, kind of amazingly fired the entire global pandemic chain of command. And so you basically have a bunch of, you know, kind of apparatchiks and bullies and third raters who are coordinating this thing. And so, I mean, just this language, I think, in particular, that they had their mental health and emotional stability questioned. Yeah. I mean, who else does that every single time his orders or his version of reality is challenged?
And also, were you surprised in that context to find out that the whistleblower herself, who was one of those who was concerned about her own health, was a woman and had her emotional stability questioned when raising a health concern?
Right. No, exactly. I mean, I feel like, you know, it's sort of par for the course with these people. And right. I mean, the cliche, which is true, is the fish rots from the head.
And that seemed well, the Washington Post says the whistleblower is seeking federal protection, alleging she was unfairly and improperly reassigned now after raising concerns about the safety of the workers to HHS officials, including those within the Office of Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar himself. It says the whistleblower has decades of experience in the field, received two HHS Department awards from Azar last year, and has received the highest performance evaluations, according to her lawyers. But she was told last week that if she does not accept the new position in 15 days, which is March 5th, she would be terminated. So, again, I know you didn't report this story, but what's your understanding from your colleagues about what would happen with this whistleblower complaint? I mean, we know the president accused the last whistleblower to make the news of treason.
Right. So my understanding, you know, is based just on what I've been reading, like everyone else, and, you know, my experience in talking to members of Congress about their oversight of this administration. I just think that, you know, you can see it not just in the handling of this whistleblower, but in the entire handling of this epidemic, in this press conference full of lies, in kind of putting Mike Pence in charge of things and basically saying that every expert has to go through him before they speak to the public, right? I mean, and this kind of phenomenon of having a crisis and having ideologues try to spin it for their own benefit, even as it gets out of control, it's not something that's unique to America, right? I mean, I think that it was the case early in the epidemic in China. In its most, you know, extreme form, it was the case in Chernobyl. And so what we're just seeing in real time is why you don't want ideologues unconcerned with empirical reality and completely untrained in public administration in charge of government at a time of national crisis.
And with Pence being put in charge of the response, people have been looking back at questions regarding his public health record as a congressman and governor of Indiana. You tweeted a quote from an op-ed Pence wrote in 2000 that the Washington Post cited yesterday. He wrote, "Time for a quick reality check. Despite the hysteria from the political class and the media, smoking doesn't kill."
Pence was directly responsible for exacerbating the HIV epidemic in Indiana with his refusal to implement a needle exchange program. So this is someone who doesn't just have like a neutral record on public health. He has a record of actively making public health problems worse because of his, aversion to letting empirical reality guide him.
Ultimately, perhaps this is reassuring, or perhaps you won't even trust this, but in pure political terms, if coronavirus gets bad in this country, it's going to look bad for Trump, especially after he downplayed it. It's going to be bad for his reelection effort. So maybe in this case, his personal interests line up with the national interest, and that'll improve the response. Or do you think that's naive?
I think that's what you would have thought, right? I mean, in certain ways, this crisis seems tailor-made to some of his most demagogic instincts, right? So you could have imagined a scenario in which he went overboard in terms of closing the border, went overboard in terms of hyping the threat instead of underplaying the threat. And I don't know why he hasn't taken that path. But I also would say that I don't think he could respond to this competently if he wanted to. I just don't think he's not capable of it. The bureaucracy is hollowed out. The good people are gone. The head of personnel in the White House is this 29-year-old who was previously fired for his gambling problem, but then brought back because Trump doesn't trust anyone else. I mean, these are just, even if these people had the purest possible motives, they don't have the bandwidth. They're not capable of carrying this out.
New York Times columnist Michelle Goldberg. She's also co-host of the Times podcast, The Argument, with us here today. New topic, the Democratic presidential race. You have written most positively about Elizabeth Warren among the candidates. But you wrote two interesting...
Right, and let me say, I wanted to say full disclosure whenever I talk about Elizabeth Warren that my husband, who's a graphic designer, has consulted for Elizabeth Warren. Although I should say he's consulting for Elizabeth Warren because we believe in her, not vice versa.
Fair enough. And yet, you wrote two interesting pro-Bernie Sanders things recently that I want to ask you about. One was your column called Putin Would Hate President Bernie Sanders. So do you think this whole equating Sanders and Russia... to Trump in Russia is getting talked about the wrong way?
I do. I think it's really outrageous to talk when people talk about Bernie as, sort of the Kremlin's candidate or as somebody who's pro-Putin. I mean, it's certainly true that Russia intervened on Sanders' behalf in 2016 as a means of sowing dissension and chaos in the Democratic Party and undermining Hillary Clinton. And it's true, according to intelligence sources, that he's intervening on Bernie's behalf again because he thinks, the same way that a lot of American pundits think, that Bernie would be the weakest opponent against Trump. And, he doesn't know that any more than any of us know that, right? I mean, I suspect that from time to time, but the polls tell us differently, and none of us really know. What I am confident of is that if Bernie Sanders were the president, Putin would end up really regretting kind of the extent to which he put his thumb on the scales, because, Bernie is not a militarist, but he's really not an isolationist. He really believes in having a sort of global alliance of liberal democracies against what he's spoken of, I think, very clearly, maybe more clearly than any of the other candidates, as this axis of authoritarianism, of which Putin is both a part and a patron. And so I think that ironically, in a Sanders-Trump race, Sanders would end up being the sort of candidate of American exceptionalism, the candidate who says that America has to stand for these liberal democratic values that Putin is trying very hard to discredit all over the world.
And the other thing you wrote that caught my eye was from your Twitter feed yesterday in response to the Times article about Democratic Party regulars looking to stop Bernie at the convention if he doesn't have a majority of the delegates. And you wrote, even if you think Sanders is an extremely risky general election candidate, which I do, this is insane and will lead Democrats to defeat. Why do you think so?
Well, because I think that, look, I understand that these are the rules and that these are the rules that Bernie Sanders helped shape. But I think that you cannot kind of come out of this process with a perception of illegitimacy. If you think about the fact the Sanders movement is a very significant part of the Democratic Party, and it also contains a lot of the people who Democrats need, but who are most kind of loosely attached to the party, right? Who are sort of pro-Bernie voters as opposed to pro-Democrat voters. And they're already, I would say, sometimes excessively paranoid about the DNC. They already feel, you know, ill-used by the process in 2016. And so if they saw it as Bernie coming in with the most votes and then people going into, you know, kind of smoke-filled rooms, not really smoke-filled rooms, but right, some sort of insider process to take it away from them, I think it would be very, very hard to keep those voters on board. So to me, it's just a sort of, it's less a question of fairness and more a question of strategy.
It's perception and strategy. Because on the merits, I mean, I could argue this one on either side. It's democracy to say the candidate who comes into the convention with the most delegates should win the nomination. But on the other side, if a candidate comes in with, say, a third of the delegates, and two-thirds of the delegates are against that person, and then they can agree on one, they'll get behind who they think is better. That's democracy too, isn't it?
Right. Well, I would say, and I actually think in Bernie's defense, that he has said a substantial plurality of delegates, right? So I don't think he's saying, he hasn't said, you know, if somebody comes in with 30%, somebody comes in with 27%, that there can be no negotiation. I think he's right about a substantial plurality. And again, I just think it's very important. Democrats need to be concerned about swing voters. They need to be concerned about the suburbanites that I fear would be really turned off by a Sanders presidency, but they also need to be concerned about Sanders voters. And they definitely need to be concerned that this huge proportion of young people who are supporting Sanders and who are sometimes sort of getting into the political process for the first time because of Sanders doesn't become disillusioned or disaffected with the Democratic Party.
And last thing, back to Warren, the Times has an article today. They saw themselves in Elizabeth Warren. So what do they see now? And it says, for some professional women, the struggles of Ms. Warren's campaign feel like a reckoning with their standing in the world. Does that ring true to you for the campaign and maybe for the larger world?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that that was true for a lot of women with Hillary Clinton. But then they heard over and over again, no, it's not a woman, it's just this woman. And they often heard from people, particularly on the left, well, I'd be happy to vote for Elizabeth Warren, just not Hillary Clinton. And then Elizabeth Warren comes along, and the criticisms of her have been so gendered, right? That she's sneaky, that she's dishonest, that she can't be trusted. I mean, she's criticized in the exact same ways that Hillary Clinton was criticized, despite having vastly different records and vastly different life stories. And the thing that's been really painful and that I think Warren has really suffered from is that because the Hillary Clinton loss was so traumatic and, you know, lost to this kind of misogynist ogre like Donald Trump, it created a question in a lot of people's minds and a lot of women's minds about whether or not a woman really could beat Donald Trump. And I think Elizabeth Warren has been held back by that. And yet at the same time, seeing her held back by that only sort of compounds the trauma.
New York Times columnist Michelle Goldberg, who also is co-host of their podcast, The Argument. Michelle, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. So much more to come.